Hi, boys and girls. I'm Spider Robinson, and you've blundered into Spider on the Web number 49, brought to you this week by chocolate cookies with white stuff in between. I'm sorry, the Jim Queskin Jug Band used to use that gag back in the day. I'm going to open this week with a little-known track by the late, great Snaker Ray. Dave Ray left us in 2002 in his sleep, and I hope in the midst of a very nice dream. He used to be one-third of the legendary folk blues group Kerner, Ray, and Glover, with Spider John Kerner and Tony Little Son Glover, and in that context he played acoustic 12-string pretty much exclusively. But here's some of his electric 6-string work from a long out-of-print 1990 album called Ashes in My Whiskey. The song's called Staring at the Ceiling.
Since you left me in the cold, baby, you know my life, it hasn't ended. But I've been living on a maintenance dose since our love has been suspended. I feel the end is drawing close. If I don't get my poor broken heart mended, most of the time I keep my love down. You know I'm from the cool school. Nobody messes with my feelings. Nobody calls me a fool. But you got me staring at the ceiling. Baby, I'm just your love too. I shuffle from door to door. Can't think, can't drink, can't eat. I feel so low down. I used to be a winner. Since you left town, baby, I'm beat. I come home looking for my dinner, find the blues all in my luncheon meat. It would take another lifetime, another set of dreams, I guess I'd have to be another man, I'd have to think another way it seems, but that's all maybe thinking and maybe land. I need you here right now, baby, I'm so cold in hand. At night I keep the lamp down low. I can't afford to see too well. To have you home is my ambition. Baby, I'm in a burning hell. Shed some light on my condition. Tell me you can feel it again the way you once have felt.
I hope you don't need me to tell you that was the great Tony Little Son Glover accompanying the Snaker on blues harp. That was a digitization of an old audio cassette copy I've got of Ashes Is My Whiskey. I wouldn't part with at any price. If you visit Amazon.com, you will find exactly 6 used copies of that album offered for sale. A vinyl LP for $40, a CD for $35, and 4 cassettes for $8 apiece. Don't let him get away. Spider John Kerner will be performing numerous times this summer at the Winnipeg Folk Festival in July. For more information, visit www.mwt.net/TildeKerner, KOERNER/. That's Tilde, you know, the little wiggly thing on its side. And to learn what Tony Glover's up to, after that last slash there, TonyGlover.html. The only gig I find on his website right now is he's playing Dunn Brothers in St. Paul this Saturday night from 9 to 11. After that, you can only hope he updates his website. And do check out the superb DVD Tony has recently released, updated with new material since the original VHS version, of the Kerner, Ray, and Glover story, with some incredible footage from back in the day and some of the last Kerner, Ray, and Glover concert ever. All right, enough of that music crap. How about a little science friction around here? I'm going to read you now a short story from the collection God is an Iron and Other Stories, published by Five Star Press in Waterville, Maine. This is basically a collection of my personal favorites of all my short work to date. This one is one of the most recent. In fact, I'm not sure, it may even be the very last short story I've written. For some reason I don't understand, I stopped getting ideas for short stories about 15 years back. It may have to do with the fact that novels pay 10 times as much, but it was not a conscious decision. I simply stopped getting short story ideas, and all the creative thoughts that passed through my brain had to do with whatever book I'm working on at the time. Here is my, as far as I know, most recent short story, Orphans of Eden. Well, what would you have done? Begin at the front part, Spider. It was just after 2 in the morning. I was right here in my office, as we call the dining room in this family, about to write a science fiction story called Orphans of Eden on this loyal, senescent Macintosh, when he appeared in the doorway from the kitchen right next to my lava lamp. I don't mean came through the doorway and stopped. I mean he appeared in the doorway. He sort of shimmered into existence like a Star Trek transportee or the ball players disappearing into the corn and field of dreams in reverse. He was my height and age, but of normal weight. His clothing was crazier than a basketball bat. I never did get the hang of the fashion assumptions behind it. I'd like to say the first thing I noticed about it was the ingenious method of fastening, but actually that was the second thing. First, I observed that his clothing pointedly avoided covering either genitals or armpits. I kind of liked that. If you lived in a nice world, why would you want to hide your smell? He stood with his hands slightly out from his sides, palms displayed, an expectant look on his extraordinarily beautiful face. He didn't look afraid of me, so I wasn't afraid of him. I hit Command-S to save my changes, a title and a handful of sentences, and forgot that story completely. Forever, now that I think about it. "When are you from?" I asked him. "Originally, I mean." I'm not going too fast for you, am I? If a guy materializes in front of you and you're sober, well, he might be the genius who just invented the transporter beam. But if he's dressed funny, he's a time traveler, right? Gotta be. Thank God the kitchen door was open, had been my very first thought. He smiled, the kind of pleased but almost rueful smile you make when a friend comes through a practical joke better than you thought he would. "Very good," he told me. It was okay, but that's not a responsive answer. "I'm sorry," he said, "but I can't say I think a lot of the question itself. Still, if it really matters to you, I was born in the year 2146, though he didn't call it that at the time, naturally. Feel better now?" He was right. It hadn't been much of a question, just the only one I could come up with on the spur of the moment. But I thought it small of him to point it out. I mean, what a spur. What a moment. And the information was mildly interesting, if useless. "You don't go around pulling this on civilians, do you?" I asked irritably. "You could give somebody a trauma." "Oh, good Lord, no," he said. "Why, half the other science fiction writers alive now would lose sphincter control if I materialized in their workplace like this." It was some comfort to think that my work might survive at least another 155 years. Unless, of course, he had run across one of my books in the middle of next week. That's because they think wonder is just another tool, like sex or violence or a sympathetic protagonist. Whereas you know it is a religion, a grail, the divine carrot that is the only thing that makes it possible for human beings to ever get anywhere without a stick across their ass. Yes, it shows in your work. You understand that only by putting his faith in wonder can a man be a moral being. So you're not afraid of me, or compelled to disbelieve in me, and you probably hadn't even gotten around to trying to figure out a way to exploit me until I just mentioned it. You're too busy wondering. I thought about it. Well, I'm sorry to say I've been wasting a good deal of time and energy on trying not to look stupid in retrospect. But yes, most of my attention has been on wonder. Before we get to the question and answer section, though, what's your name? Why? He asked. There's only one of me. Suppose I want to swear at you. He gave a smaller version of that faintly annoying smile. Good point. My name is Daniel. My wife's ex-husband is named Daniel. Also amazing. Also faintly annoying at times. Would you mind if I went and woke up my wife? She'd be sore if I let her sleep through this. Jeannie enjoys looking at very beautiful men. Obviously. Our teenager, on the other hand, would doubtless find a 200-year-old grown-up 5 times more boring than me, and enough music to wake her, the only thing that will do the trick, would probably also wake the tenants downstairs in the basement suite. And would you care for some coffee? He shuddered slightly, then saw my expression. Sorry, that was for the coffee, not your wife. Imagine I brought you back to a Cro-Magnon's cave and he offered you refreshments. My turn to apologize. Sorry, I wasn't thinking. As to Jeannie, please don't misunderstand. I would be honored to meet her under other circumstances, another time. Your collaborations with her are even better than your solo work. I nodded strong agreement. But if I correctly decipher her input therein, she is a Soto Zen Buddhist and a sentimentalist. What's wrong with that? I demanded. Nothing at all, but I seek advice on a practical matter of morality, and you understand how omelets are made. I frowned. Do you mind if the Cro-Magnon has a little cup of jaguar blood to help him think? This is your house, he said simply. Well, actually, it isn't. I'm a writer. I rent. But I knew what he meant and agreed with it. I thought about that while I turned another cup of water into dark Tanzanian magic and spooned in sugar and whipped cream. By the time I tipped the old Bushmills into the coffee, my Irish was up. Before we start, I said. Yes? He was watching my preparations with the same gravity I'd like to think I could bring to watching an autopsy. You have managed to be sufficiently interesting that I will forgive you this once, I said. But if you ever again drop in without phoning ahead first like that, I'll set the cat on you. He did not quite look wildly around. Do you have a cat? I winced. Smokey was killed a month ago by some asshole motorist in a hurry. One of the best masters I ever served. I'll get one if necessary, and I don't want to hear any guff when you reach my answering machine either. It's always on. People should be grateful I let them leave messages.
Understood and agreed, he said.
And I apologize, but in my defense, what would you have done if I had left a phone message?
I nodded.
That's why I forgive you this once.
I made one last try at hospitality.
I can offer you charcoal-filtered water.
Thank you, no.
I pointed to a kitchen chair and took the one across the table from it for myself. He sat beautifully, like a dancer or one of Jeannie's Alexander Technique students. I took a long, appreciative sip of my Irish coffee.
I'm listening, Daniel, I said. Before we start...
Yeah?
When will you begin to get excited?
Oh, about a minute after you leave, I hope. By then I can afford to.
He nodded. We both knew I was lying. The cup was trembling. He really was trying to be polite.
Why was he trying so hard to be polite?
You spoke of wanting my advice on a practical matter of morality, I went on. Is this an ends-justifying-means kind of deal?
I had succeeded in impressing him.
You have succeeded in impressing me, he said. Yes.
I sighed.
You've read Mind Killer.
He nodded. It's one of my scarier books. One or two critics, after having had someone literate summarize it for them, have declared that it says the end justifies the means. Beginning for the first time to be a little scared myself, I said,
And have you got the secrets of Mind Wipe and Mind Write?
Oh, no, he said, convincingly enough to make me relax again.
What's holding things up? I asked. I expected that stuff to come along well before 2040.
You vastly underestimate the complexity of modeling the brain. I nodded philosophically. It's going around these days. Well, I'm relieved, I guess. I had to force that happy ending. That happens to me a lot in the serious books.
He nodded again. But you keep doing it. Splendid.
Thank you. The better the flattery, the warier I become. Back to business.
Then I am to assume that you have another moral dilemma as sharp as the one faced by Jacques in Mindkiller?
It is to me. I want you to tell me if I am a monster, or simply a victim of my inability not to ask the next question.
Or both, I pointed out.
Or both, he agreed. I took another long gulp of Irish coffee. I've since worked out to my own satisfaction the one about a writer's responsibility, but I'd always known that book would come back to haunt me one day.
Let me get this straight. You have already done whatever this thing is. Some would call it monstrous, and now you want my opinion on whether or not you were right to do it. Why, since it's too late?
I need to know if I dare go public, in my own ficton, my own space-time. If I can't persuade you, I can't persuade anybody.
I'd always had the sneaking idea I'd make a good judge, if only there weren't so damn many laws. Time to find out if I was right.
First tell me your ends, then your means, if you can do it that way.
I can approach it that way, he said, but the ends imply the means. I can put it in a nutshell. I wanted to do meaningful sociological experiments.
I understood him at once because he was speaking to the heart of the science fiction story I'd intended to write. But in case I only thought I understood him, I dragged the exposition out of him like a good character should.
What do you mean?
I think you suspect, he said. Most of the really important questions about human societies are unanswerable because you can't contain the size of the question. You can't understand the ancient Romans if you don't know about all their neighbors and trading partners and subject peoples, and you can't really grasp any of them any better because they all influence each other helter-skelter, and you can't even get a start on any one of them until you know their whole history back to their year one. It's the history that's even worse than the local complexity. So much of any society is vestigial, the original reasons for its fundamental assumptions forgotten. And it's the history that always gets in the way of trying to make things better. Look at your own contemporary ficton. Can you imagine any permanent solution to the Irish problem or the Serbo-Croatian problem or the Palestinian-Jewish problem or any one of 100 others like them that does not involve giving everyone involved mass amnesia and erasing all the history books?
Well, yes, I said, but it won't come soon, now that you tell me telepathy isn't even going to be as easy as time travel.
Well, for all I know, telepathy could come along before 2300, he said. I left in 2292.
I calculated without much surprise that he was at least 144 subjective years old.
And one of the limitations of time travel, a blessed one in my opinion, is that you cannot go further forward in time than you have already been. The only way to see the future is to live it. But I'm not expecting telepathy soon, then soon, either.
I finished my coffee. I'm sorry to hear that. Still, there's no real hurry. Once we have telepathy and time travel, we can build heaven or a reasonable facsimile retroactively.
As in your book, Time Pressure, he agreed. But since I don't expect that soon and can't depend on it ever, I'm trying to save the human race in a different way. There is some urgency about the matter. When I come from, we have come very close to destroying ourselves in catastrophic warfare.
Nanotechnological?
Worse. I strongly advise you to leave it at that.
I could not repress the shudder, or the squirm that followed it. I had been wondering if he was too evolved to have immunities for primitive local germs. Just wondering, not worrying, as I believe a man's health is his business. Now I was reminded that there are circumstances under which a man's health is your business. Was Daniel carrying anything?
Too late to worry now.
What kind of a ficton is it?
He hesitated.
Well, it's hard to give you a meaningful answer. Imagine I'm a Cro-Magnon. Tell me, what's your world like? giddy with fear and pride and guilt and shame, but trying to be as decent as it can.
He nodded thoughtfully.
Okay. In those terms, the 2290s are sullen, scared, and preoccupied with the present. In the immediate past is horror, and just beyond that are the things that inexorably brought it on us, and still we prefer not to think over much of the future. We see what went wrong and don't know how to fix it. As near as we can see, all the future holds is another slow, painful climb to the pinnacle which blasts all who stand on it, and those of us who think about that wonder what's the point. So not many of us think about it.
I was more grateful than ever to have lived my life in the 20th century, but I was also puzzled.
Well, it's hard to square that with your clothes. That kind of outfit and that kind of world doesn't ring true. People like that would cover up.
He smiled sadly.
These clothes were designed elsewhere.
Skip irrelevancies. The night was old.
Okay, so what do you figure to do about your situation?
He clasped his fingers before him, together on the table, with his spine so straight it made him look as if he were praying.
It's all the history, you see. The weight of all that history, all those mistakes we can't ever undo or forget.
I can understand that.
Probably you can. The problem is just now beginning to become apparent. Time was when the maximum length of history was the number of stories an old man could tell before he died. Then we got too damn good at recording and preserving the stories. At about the same time, there began to be too many stories, and they all interacted. And then came the information explosion. Human beings are only built to tolerate the knowledge of so much failure and tragedy. All the things we've ever done to warp the human spirit, from making wars to making gods, are there in us at the root of anything we plant, at the base of anything we build. When you try to start all over again from scratch, you find out you can't. Your definition of scratch merely defines the direction history has warped you in and condemns you to tug in the other direction, but the weave is too complex to straighten. It's too late for us to start over. It's too late to try to create a society without taboos. The people who would try it are warped by the knowledge of what a taboo is. It's too late to try and create a society without sexual repression. The parents invariably, inevitably pass along to their children at least warped shadows of the repressions they inherited themselves. It's too late to make a society without racism, and so on. Every attempt at an experimental utopian community has failed, no matter how hard they tried to keep themselves isolated from the surrounding world. Sealing yourself up in a self-sustaining space colony and smashing all your comm gear doesn't help. It's just too late to experiment with a society that has no possessions or conformity or tribalism or irrational religions. All possible experimental subjects are compromised by their knowledge of human history. What's needed is some way to put an undo key on history.
I think I see where you're going, I said. I was just about to write a story about...
I know, he interrupted me. And you were going to screw it up.
We'll never know, will we?
Go on.
Well, I think you know the only possible solution.
Let's do a thought experiment.
I know you won't mind the pun. Hypothetically, put a bunch of pre-verbal children, infants for preference, in a congenial artificial environment. Plenty of room, plenty of food for the taking... Mild climate, no predators, an adequate supply of useful materials and appropriate technology for later. Immunize them all against the old disease and give them doctor robots that will see them in adulthood and then fall apart. Provide AI packages to teach language skills and basic hygiene, both carefully vetted to be as semantically value-free as possible.
Have the AI design the language, I suggested.
Yes, open-ended, but with just enough given vocabulary to sustain a complicated thought. Let them invent their own. A clean foundation. When they're ready to handle it, have the machines teach them the basic principles of mathematics and science, using numbers rather than words wherever possible, and just enough philosophy to keep them from brewing up organized religion, and not a damned word of history. Then you go away and come back in 1,000 years.
To find them knifing each other over which one has the right to sacrifice a peasant to the teaching machines, I said.
You are not really that cynical.
Of course I am. Why do you think I have to keep writing those happy endings? You know, another writer wrote a story years ago with that same basic theme as your thought experiment.
Yes, he said. And what was the first thing his protagonist did? Saddled the poor little bastards with the author's own religion. gifted them with shame and sin and an angry but bribable paternalistic God and a lot of other moral mumbo-jumbo. Phooey, he had greatness in his hands and he blew it. That time.
I didn't quite agree, but the differences were quibbles, and I had something else to think about. This wasn't a science fiction story Daniel was describing, or any cockamamie thought experiment.
I once heard a black woman use some memorable language. She described someone as having been as ugly as death backing out of an outhouse reading Mad Magazine, ugly enough to make a freight train take a dirt road.
All at once, I thought uglier than that was slithering around under my hair.
Talk about cynical, I went on. Why don't we get down to the crucial problem with this little thought experiment, as you call it?
I was looking him in the eye, and he did not look away. But he didn't answer me either. So I did.
The problem is, where do you get the infants?
Yes, he said slowly. That was the problem. I poured more Irish coffee, omitting coffee cream and sugar. When it was gone, I said,
"So you're the guy that laid the bad rap on all those gypsies."
I was trying hard not to hate him. I try not to hate anybody, no matter how much it seems indicated, until I've walked around it a little while. And he hadn't said he was through talking yet. But so far I really hated this. He looked confused for the first time since I'd met him. Then he got the reference.
No, that wasn't me any more than it was gypsies. As far as I know, that child-stealing gossip was sheer wishful thinking on the part of parents, combined with a natural hatred of anyone who didn't have to stay in the village they were born in. I've never stolen a baby anywhere in time.
Then where did you get them? Roll your own, in a test tube or a petri dish or whatever, with the donors and form volunteers?
Even if the answer was yes, I didn't like this one any better. Call up human beings out of nothingness to be born or decanted or whatever and suffer and die for purely scientific reasons. At least the first generation of them, compelled to grow up without parents or role models, forced to reinvent love and law and humor and a trillion other things I took for granted, if they could, grow babies as guinea pigs.
I've never made a baby either, he said. Not even with someone else's genes.
I frowned.
Then I give up, Mr. Bones. How did that time traveler?
Oh. Then I said, oh. And finally, oh. A lot of infants have been abandoned on a lot of windy hillsides or left in dumpsters since time began, he said sadly. If Pharaoh's daughter had happened to miss Moses, she probably could have picked up another one the next day. It tends to happen most in places and times where, even if the child had somehow miraculously been found and taken in by some contemporary, it would have had a maximum life expectancy of about 30 years. So I denied some of them the comfort of a nice quick death by exposure or predator, brought them to a safe place, and gave them the means to live in good health for hundreds of years.
And use them as guinea pigs, I said,
but without any real heat in it. I was beginning to see his logic. He didn't duck it.
That's right. Now you tell me, are my actions forgivable?
Give me a minute, I said, and poured more whiskey and thought.
Thou shalt not use human beings as guinea pigs.
Don't be silly, Spider. Accept that, and you've just tossed out most of medicine. Certainly all the vaccines. First you use guinea pigs, sure, but sooner or later you have to try it on a human or you're just a veterinarian, and meanwhile people are dying in pain.
Thou shalt not experiment on human beings without their informed consent.
Many valuable psych experiments collapse with informed consent. You can't experiment with the brain chemistry of a schizophrenic without endangering his life. You can't find out whether slapping an hysteric will calm him down by asking him. You have to try it and see what happens. Daniel's, too, is an experiment which by definition may not have informed consent. Informing the subject destroys the experiment. Is there written anywhere some fundamental law forbidding a man to withhold information, even if he believes it to be potentially harmful?
Thou shalt not use infants as guinea pigs.
Hogwash, for the same reasons as number one above. How do you test an infant mortality preventative if not on an infant? Should we not have learned how to do fetal heart surgery? Do not the benefits of amniocentesis outweigh the, please God, few who will inevitably be accidentally skewered? Would Daniel's orphans really be better off dead than in Eden?
Thou shalt not plague God.
Well, God knows someone has to, especially if the future is as grim as Daniel says. And she hasn't been answering her phone lately. When it comes down to the crunch, humans have always tried to plague God if they thought they could pull it off. Ah, there was the crux.
And what kind of results have you gotten? I asked.
His face split in a broad grin.
Ah, there's the crux, isn't it? If you examine the data that came out of the Nazi death camps and profit from that terrible knowledge, are you any better than Dr. Mengele?
I winced.
That is the question I want you to answer, he said. You are completely insulated from any possible backlash to your answer. The people who will ultimately judge me will never know you were consulted, even after the fact. There is no stick to be applied to you as a result of your answer, and now I will offer the carrot, the same carrot that got me into this.
I was already reaching for the whiskey. Damn it, I thought, this isn't fair. All I ever tried to do was entertain people.
Balls,
came the answer from deep inside.
If you tell me that constructing the experiment was a moral act, he went on inexorably, I will tell you everything I can about the results.
Well, what would you have done?
And now a couple of tracks from one of my favorite albums, sadly completely unobtainable these days, a Spider John Kerner album, a legendary one called Music Is Just a Bunch of Notes. Spider John recorded the thing in Snaker Dave Ray's garage at Sweet Jane Limited, issued, as I understand it, 1,000 copies. They included in each copy a little cost accounting sheet which showed how much money they spent, how much it cost to make 1,000 copies, and showed that by selling these records for $2 a piece, they would make 100% profit, and alerting you that if you had been charged more than $2, you should go back to the rip-off pig who sold it to you and tell him he's a fascist. Oddly, it was not well distributed for some reason, and here's one of the very few opportunities you'll be liable to ever get to hear some. A couple of original Kerner songs called Thief River Falls and Taking My Time. And then we're going to close out with a little bit of spoken word from a total lunatic named Tom Olson.
One, two. In the city, skinny Jimmy's taking chances with another man's wife. Making advances on the wildlife. Along comes Jones, the scary man.
do I start? How does it start? One, do I go one, two, three, and then just start?
No.
One.
Dun, 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 dun.
Oh, that's right. One, two.
I've been sitting right here thinking. I've been drinking this bottle of love beer. But not tomorrow, it may be. And I'll still be sitting right here. Hey, it may be a week, maybe a month or two.
The freeway is this?
I don't know.
Dang it, man. No billboards, no buildings. Just green meadows, man, far as you can see.
Yeah, it is weird.
No other traffic, man. We got the highway all ourselves. Think I'll see what's on the radio. Can't get nothing. Guess it don't work.
No, it never has.
Oh. Really moving, ain't we?
Yeah, we'll be there in a flash.
Speedometer broke?
Oh, yeah.
The old boat really moves out.
Oh, yeah.
Hey, maybe could you kind of ease off a little bit? I'm kind of nervous. This is a little too fast for me, I think.
Say, you know what?
What?
The accelerator stuck.
Huh?
Yeah, right to the floor. I don't even have my foot on it.
Come on, what do you mean? The gas pedal stuck?
What do you mean, what do I mean? It's stuck. Look at it.
Well, jeepers, man. Maybe I ought to pull over or something.
I don't know how I'm going to pull over. The steering seems to be out.
Steering's out? What are you talking about? You're crazy, man.
Look, can I help it? Look at it. It's looser than hell.
That's impossible. Put on the brakes or something.
Look at my foot. Right to the floor.
There's got to be brakes. What are you telling me?
What do you mean there's got to be brakes? Look at it.
How could the gas pedal be stuck in the brakes and the steering wheel be out all at the same time? Slow this car down, darn it.
Slow it down yourself. You drive. Go ahead, drive. I'm getting the back seat.
Hey, what are you crazy? You're telling me you must be out of your mind. Don't, man, don't.
Hey, dig that.
What? What the hell is that?
It looks like a wall.
A wall? What the hell would they build a wall right across the freeway for? What's the matter with you? Crazy or something? What the hell's going on? What is this?
Beats me.
Tom Olson has three tracks on Music is Just a Bunch of Notes, and all three of them cracked me up. I wish he Googled up a little better. If anybody out there has any idea what Tom Olson is up to these days, I hope you'll hit me. And now one more story from God is an Iron and Other Stories, copyright 2002 by Spider Robinson. This one is called Local Champ. With a depressingly large part of his consciousness, the warlock watched the damn fool who was trying to kill him this time. Depressing because it rubbed his nose in the fact that he simply had nothing more pressing to think about. He had not sunk so low that assassins threatened him. Rather, he had risen so high that they were a welcome relief from boredom. You must understand that he was unquestionably and indisputably the mightiest warlock the world had ever known. For twice 10,000 years he had owned it. It was barely within the realm of conceivability that another as mighty as he could simultaneously exist, but they could no more have escaped each other's notice than two brontosaurs in the same pond. There had never been such a one. Further, he was invulnerable. Not just physically, although that was nice, of course, but really. A warlock, any sorcerer, can only be truly destroyed by a spell using his name, and it had been thrice 5,000 years since the last living being who knew the warlock's name had gone down to the final death. Since that time he had induced certain subtle mutations in the human race so that no man now living could have pronounced his name had they known it. His most deadly secret was literally unstealable. He suffered other minor wizards to live and work, since they kept life interesting and made tolerable servants. When they reached their 2,000th birthday, he methodically killed or utterly destroyed them as indicated. He could never be seriously challenged. In a way, he was almost flattered by this latest would-be assassin. Though the warlock had spent centuries becoming the nastiest and most sadistic being it was within him to be, which was considerable, it had been a long time since anyone had hated him even more than they feared him. When the bugs always scurry away, you lose the fun of stepping on them. He felt something very like fondness for this gallant little bug, amused approval of its audacity. Briefly he contemplated an act of mercy, allowing the poor wretch to live out its 2,000 years in utter agony, and then simply killing it. Anyone who knows anything knows that even 2,000 years of torment and physical death are preferable to the real death, the final extinction. The most unpleasant points on the wheel of karma are infinitely preferable to the awful emptiness within which it turns. But even that much charity was alien to the warlock. The impulse passed. Besides, great wizards, and the occasional especially apt sorcerer, reincarnated with their necromantic potential intact, if not mildly amplified, and there was no assurance that this young upstart would profit from the lesson. Humans seldom did. This tendency toward rebelliousness, piquant though it might be, was not, after all, something a prudent master of the world should encourage. From his high eyrie, the warlock observed the pitiful pile of junk being raised up against him with perhaps a quarter of his attention and sighed. You may, reading between the lines, have acquired the suspicion that the mighty warlock was something of a secret coward. Well, what kind of man did you think
craves that kind of power badly enough to grasp it barehanded, to do what must be done to get it. This was the warlock's bane. Millennia of utter security had nearly succeeded in boring the beard off him, and yet facing the problem squarely would have entailed admitting that he was too cowardly to permit any change in his circumstances. For the warlock, millennia of boredom were preferable to even a significant possibility that precious, irreplaceable he could be hurled from the wheel. He preferred not to dwell on this with any part of his consciousness. Not that this would-be assassin even remotely alarmed him. The portion of his awareness that had absently divined its magicidal intent, and now idly watched its secret preparations for battle, felt, as has been said, some amusement, something like fondness, but not paternal, which warlocks are sterile as witches. But his overriding emotion was something more than scorn, but less than true contempt.
"Same old fallacies," he thought. "First they acquire a rudimentary mind shield, and they get cocky, as though I needed to read their thoughts to outthink them," he snorted. "And then they put their money on physical energies 3 times out of 5. They discover that magic, deeply rooted in the earth, is limited to a sphere of 100 miles around the planet, while physical energies are not, and they decide that that somehow implies a superiority of some kind. Ephemerals."
He recalled the last really challenging duel he had ever fought, countless centuries before. He and the other had met on the highest peak on Earth, locked eyes for 3.5 years, and then touched the tips of their index fingers together. The site of this meeting would one day be called the Marianas Trench, and the concussion had produced even more damage in the other plane. The warlock looked upon the massive assemblage of machineries which was supposed to threaten his, well, you couldn't say his life even in jest, could you, his peace of mind then, and he sneered. This building full of junk was to be raised up against him, could you?
"Nothing but a big beam of coherent light," he complained to himself. "Surely that silly creature can deduce that I'm transparent to the entire electromagnetic spectrum. Hell knows it has clues enough. I meditate above the ionosphere for decades at a time. I've a quarter of a mind to let the impertinent upstart shoot that thing at me before I kill it, just to see its face."
About that much of his mind considered the question for a few months. Meanwhile, the bulk of his awareness, as it had for the last 8 centuries, devoted itself to a leisurely study of how best to mutate human stock so as to increase the central nervous system's capacity to support agony. Mess with the hypothalamus? Add new senses? Subtle, satisfying stuff.
"By hell, I will," decided that quarter of his mind then. "I'll let the impudent cretin fire its toy at me, and I won't even notice. I'll ignore its attack completely, and it will go mad with rage. In fact, I'll be rather nice to it for about 100 years, and then I'll arbitrarily destroy it for some trivial offense or other. Delicious."
The quarter of the warlock's mind which troubled itself with this matter savored the joy of anticipation for several months, so thoroughly, in fact, that he actually did fail to notice when the upstart wizard's harmless energy bolt passed through the space occupied by his body. The reflex that caused his physical essence to sidestep into the other plane was so automatic, so unimportant, that it took a few weeks to come to even a quarter of his attention. He chuckled at that. He also monitored the wizard's frustrated, impotent rage, at least on audio and video. Those damned mind shields were a nuisance sometimes, and found it good. He invested a fortnight in devising a fiendishly offhand destruction for the fool, instructed himself to remember the affair in a century or so, and forgot the matter. Those came to be called the last 100 years of pain, and they were long. At last, like a child recalling a hoarded sweet, the warlock rummaged in his mental pockets and turned out the matter of the hapless wizard. Memory reported that several other shots had been fired without disturbing his peace. The mortal gave every indication of being sobbing mad. Its aim, for instance, had been going to hell for the last 2 or 3 decades. Some of its shots had missed him by wide margins. He chuckled and abandoned his century-old plan for destroying the white without ever acknowledging its attacks.
"The hell, I'll tell it. It's more fun if it knows I've been playing with it."
At once he was standing before the wizard in the building of futile engines, clothed in fire. In his left hand was a sword that shimmered and crackled. In his right hand was something that could not be looked upon, even by him. Oddly, considering its displayed stupidity, the ephemeral did not seem surprised to see him. Its anger was gone as if it had never been. It met his gaze with something absurdly like serenity. Machines began to melt around them, and the wizard teleported outdoors, the warlock, of course, following without thinking about it, they faced each other about 500 feet above the top of the highest of many local mountains, and they locked eyes. "You have come to destroy me," the wizard said quietly.
"Of course," the warlock sent mentally, disdaining speech. "Lasers are harmless to me, of course, but they wouldn't be against one of you, and that makes it an insult."
He frowned.
"Had you dared attempt a genuine necromantic assault, I might have been amused enough to simply kill you hideously."
He gestured with a crackling sword at the building below them, which was also crackling now.
"But this incompetence must be culled from the breed."
"We all do what we can," the wizard said.
"Indeed. Well, here you go."
He rummaged in his subconscious's name file, came up with the wizard's true name, which was Jessica, incorporated that name into the thing in his right hand, and reached out toward the mortal, and,
"Not here!" she cried, and was teleporting upward like a stone hurled by a giant. And why the hell not, the wizard thought as he pursued the creature effortlessly, intrigued enough to let a good 60 or 70 miles go by before deciding that enough was enough and hurling the thing in his right hand after her and averting his eyes.
She died the real death, then. Her soul was destroyed instantly and forever, in a detonation so fierce that it was almost physically tangible. The warlock grunted in satisfaction, and was about to return to his eyrie, when he noted that the wizard's physical body continued to exist, an empty hulk still hurtling skyward. It chanced that the warlock had not had lunch that decade. Straining a bit to reach it before it passed the limits of the sphere of sorcery, he retrieved the corpse and poised there a moment with the crackling sword ready in his left hand, and felt the mind shield he had accreted over 10,000 years peeled away like the skin of an orange, felt his true name effortlessly extracted from his memory, felt himself gripped as though between some monstrous thumb and forefinger, and plucked from the sphere of his power, yanked over closer to the sun where the light was better, and in the few helpless boiling blood seconds before he died both kinds of death, the most powerful warlock in all the history of the world had time to understand 3 things. That the laser beams had not been aimed at him, that lasers can carry information great distances, and that this world is only one of billions in a sea of infinity. Then at last the end of all fear came to him, as it had come a century before, to Saint Jessica.
All right, that's a full lid. Thank you for your sympathy, ladies and gentlemen. We appreciate your subscriptions, your donations, and your good thoughts generally. And please don't forget that Better Bookstores everywhere are eager to sell you a copy of my latest novel, Very Hard Choices, in Bane hardcover, or the Lifehouse Trilogy in Bane hardcover, or, for that matter, the Stardance Trilogy. And there are still some tore paperback copies of my collaboration with Robert A. Heinlein, Variable Star. If you'd like signed or personalized copies of any of these, Google up the bookstore, White Dwarf Books in Vancouver. Now to take us out of here are a couple of tracks from Spider John Kerner, the closing track of his album Raised by Humans, and the closing track of his most recent album, charmingly entitled Stargazer. Take it, Spider John.
I have seen stars in the daytime. I've seen sunshine at midnight. I seen good guys do wrong and bad guys do right. I seen black crows and white seagulls fly the perfect flight, and another day never fails to bring another night. The moon sails around the earth, and the earth sails around the sun, and our own turning round counts the days one by one. First breath in a strange land, breathless at the deeming of the last hand, and in between the dream you dream and the shifting of the sand.
And now the purple dusk of twilight time steals across the meadows of my heart. High up in the sky, the little stars climb
always reminding me that we're apart. You wander down the lane and far away, leaving me a song that will not die. Love is now the stardust of yesterday, the music of the years gone by. Sometimes I wonder why I spend the lonely night dreaming of a song. The melody haunts my reverie, and I am once again with you. When our love was new, and each kiss an inspiration. But that was long ago. Now my consolation is in the stardust of a song. Beside a garden wall, when stars are bright, you are in my arms. The nightingale tells his fairy tale of paradise where roses grow. Though I dream in vain, in my heart it will remain. My stardust melody, the memory of love's refrain.
Like all of them, this episode of Spider on the Web was brought to you under Creative Commons license, no derivatives, non-commercial. See you next week.